The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. The title of today's show is Stand Up Economics with our guest, Yoram Bauman. Did I pronounce that correct, Yoram?
Yes.
Okay, good. Because, my last name, Ledevis, nobody pronounces that right. I'm not sure where we're going to go, but I got to tell you, we are pleased to have you on the program because we have a longstanding tradition of having physicists, electrical engineers, biologists, myself, a chemical engineer, who do science and applied science like engineering, but also do comedy. So Yoram did his PhD in economics at the University of Washington and actually did your bachelor's degree at Reed College. Now, that was in math, wasn't it?
That's correct.
Okay. So a nice illustration of the multidisciplinary nature of science and applied science today. A lot of our folks that come on the program may have a bachelor's or master's degree that's different than their doctorate degree. He lives in Seattle with his wife, Laura, and later in the show I'm going to ask you what your wife thinks of this rather strange juxtaposition of stand-up comedy and economics. My good friend Tim Lee, who's a biologist turned comedian, is not married, and I think we know why. And my wife hasn't killed me yet, so hopefully your wife, Laura, is more understanding of this. And according to your webpage, which, by the way, you can reach on insidetheblackbox.org if you're interested in more about what Yoram is doing, your goal is to spread joy to the world through economics comedy, to reform economics education and implement carbon pricing, preferably through a revenue-neutral tax shifting involving lower taxes on things we like, working, saving, investing, and higher taxes on things we don't, e.g. carbon. And you perform all over the country. In addition to doing some teaching, you're involved in a lot of meetings, lecturing. You perform at various venues, including colleges, mixing the two things, right, economics and comedy. So the first question I have to ask you is, what were you drinking when you decided to mix comedy and economics?
I was drinking graduate school.
Okay, yeah, so, that's not the Kool-Aid. You're absolutely right.
So it started by accident. It started when I was in graduate school at the University of Washington. This was about 10 years ago. And I wrote a parody of an economics textbook.
Mm-hmm. Is that the cartoon guide to microeconomics?
No, that came later.
Okay.
That's a real book.
Okay.
The parody was, there's a famous economics textbook that is based on these 10 principles of economics.
Right.
And so I wrote just to blow off steam, I wrote a parody of those 10 principles. It kind of got passed around the department and people laughed at it. And then it ended up getting published in the Annals of Improbable Research, which is a science humor journal.
Right.
And then those folks run a humor session every year at the big science convention in the U.S., the AAAS meetings, the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
Ah, I did not know that.
And in 2004, it just happened to be in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
So they invited me to present my paper. And I did, and I had so much fun that I kind of got into stand-up comedy as a hobby and started going down to open mic nights down at the Comedy Underground here in town.
Right.
And the nice thing about stand-up comedy as a business is that there are no barriers to entry, as we say in economics, right? You don't need an advanced degree. You don't need to go to school. You just need to go down to open mic night and put your name on the list, and then you get 2 minutes just like every other joker.
Yeah.
And so I kind of got into stand-up comedy as a hobby, and then it turned out that I had a little interesting niche of the comedy world, and the fact that there's no barriers to entry also explains why it's very difficult to make money as a comedian, because it's a very competitive market. But I have a little segment of the market, right? I can differentiate my product.
Right.
And so I know a thing or two about monopoly pricing as an economist.
Ah, nice.
So now this year is the first year that I'm making my living full-time from doing comedy.
Right. That's good. And being an economist, I'm sure you've actually thought that out and you know something about the inputs and the outputs related to that. Because, of course, most of my comedian friends, when they first tell me, you know, I said, Pete, we've gone out full time. I'm a full time comedian. That usually translates to weed dealer. So, you know, full time for a regular comedian doesn't necessarily mean exactly the same thing. I did not know that the AAAS had a section on humor. Have they been doing that for a long time?
I think they've been doing it for maybe 15, 20 years or something.
Okay, wow. And
so definitely check it out. I think maybe it comes to Atlanta on occasion, the AAAS.
Well, we will have to look into that. And I'm not sure, Tim Lee, my biology friend, I've got physicist friends, electrical engineering friends, my colleague here at Georgia Tech, Lou Lefton, has a PhD in mathematics, and actually used to work with Ken Jeong of Hangover fame. And a lot of people don't realize Ken Jeong started doing improv and stand-up comedy when he was a resident in Louisiana after having got his medical degree at University of North Carolina. So there are a lot more geeks out there like we are doing stand-up comedy. Before we talk about whether or not humor can have a positive effect on on the teaching of economics, which I think fits in with my field, chemical engineering, something nobody really likes to talk about. And if they learned in a school, they don't want to remember it all. We're going to do our segment that I don't know where the liner is for this one, but it's a segment we call Science in the News. And for today's Science in the News, I want to thank one of our regular listeners, Fred from Decatur, Georgia, who sent me this article by Ian Frazier from the May 20th issue of The New Yorker, entitled Form and Fungus. And it has to do with the Ecovative Design LLC, founded by Gavin McIntyre and Eben Beyer, two former Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute students who found a way to replace that polystyrene foam packing, you know, that you put in the corner of boxes, with fungus specifically. And it's a really great article. It talks about how they started with a $15,000 grant from the National Collegiate Inventors and Innovators Alliance, and with some free space from RPI's incubators. Georgia Tech and a lot of places have incubators where they can start out companies. They actually teamed up with a Skidmore biologist named Sue Van Hook, who read an article about their activities and knew something about maybe how to optimize the fungus to grow it into something that looks like a corner piece to do packing, you know, for expensive equipment that you might ship across the country. They specifically picked a fungus that used chitin, right? Chitin is a polysaccharide that has an amide side chain hanging off of it. And what amazed me is that now this thing is actually, and maybe this is relevant to our guest today, economically feasible. And it's a great illustration that processing is expensive, right? As a chemical engineer, we process everything. That's all we do is processing. And the problem is that we've been looking at this polymer chitin and a derivative of that called chitosan for decades. They're great all-natural polymers. They're very, very rigid. You can make them into all sorts of structural elements, packing elements, things like that. But the problem is if you get them from plants or if you get them from shrimp shells or crab shells or things like this, the amount of time and energy that you spend processing the polymer to then reshape it into what you want is so expensive, uses up so many resources, so much money, and so much energy that it's just not worth it. And it's a good illustration as to why everyone's making fun of those of us who try to make fuels or things out of cellulosics. We also want to do the same thing out of crab shells. Like I said, we've been doing that for years. Corn ethanol is another good example. They have all-natural products. They are renewable resources. They are really, really good. But the amount of time that folks like us, the chemical engineers, spend to break them down, right? Cellulose was designed by Mother Nature not to be broken down. If you don't believe me, take a look at wood. And then put it in that nice little shape. It's very, very expensive. So with this article, and if you get a chance to read it by Ian Frazier, it's extremely well-read, or extremely well-written. It illustrates that if you can get Mother Nature to do the processing for you, it eliminates all this cost, right? So the Brazilian guys do much better because sugar cane as an input for the processing is much better than corn. Likewise here, they literally teach this fungus to grow. They grow it in the shape of a little corner packing piece. Then they put some chemicals on it to kill the fungus, and boom, they have chitin and other structural materials all ready to go. And take a look at this, because this is going to be growing very, rare, very, very rapidly in the years to come. And once again, thanks to Fred from Decatur. Fred, I was so enamored with this article, we actually called the guys at the company, Ecovative Design LLC, tried to get them on the show. They're doing so well, they didn't even have time to talk to us. But nonetheless, there's a good example of how processing often determines things. Okay, so let's get back to the whole comedy and economics. Is it safe to say that people that study micro and macroeconomics do not have a good taste in their mouth after they've taken that course in college?
For a lot of people, it's not their favorite class in college. That's right. Probably a fair statement.
Okay. So can humor, and this is one of the things you're interested in, can humor help us teach it better, engage the public better in this very important scientific endeavor?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a tremendous part of the educational process, and one that I think we forget about is the motivational factor about, okay, so you give the student this, like, 600-page textbook, but then what, you know, why are they going to open it up, or why are they going to do anything other than sort of cram the night before the final exam? And I think lightening things up with humor and telling jokes is a great way to connect to students if that's something that you can do. And then I think it's broader than humor, though. They're also just there are great stories in economics, and I think in many ways, introductory economics classes kind of hide the light under the bushel, you know, like they purposely, mostly for historical reasons, they focus on supply and demand, which tends to be pretty dry stuff, mm-hmm. and leave out, for example, game theory and all sorts of really interesting, interesting parts of economics that I feel like we should spend more time talking about and using to get students interested in economics.
So you're saying humor is just one example of this sort of interesting personal narrative, right, that puts economic theory in context, right? It talks about, you know, how it changes the economy, how it has changed the outcome of societal events and wars and things like that. So we should be using the narrative more?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important. It's people relate to stories, so... Right. You know, what's the story of free trade? What's the story right. of the tragedy of the commons, for example, or the invisible hand?
Mm-hmm.
The only part of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations that people remember from 1776 is the one sentence where he uses the phrase "invisible hand." You know, people are guided as if by an invisible hand to achieve a part that was no part of their intention.
Right.
And the fascinating question behind that statement is sort of the interesting question in economics, and microeconomics at least. The fundamental question is you've got all these, the game that we play as microeconomists is you have all these individuals in the world, and each individual is just looking out for number one. They're sort of, they're not necessarily selfish, but they're myopic or short-sighted or sort of self-interested. And the interesting question in microeconomics is, what is the aggregate group result of all these self-interested people running around interacting with each other? You know, is it going to lead to chaos? Is it going to lead to disaster? Is it going to lead to something amazing? And it turns out, and this was what Adam Smith was talking about with the invisible hand, that in many cases, you get these amazing outcomes as a result of this individual self-interested behavior that you might initially think would just produce chaos.
So it almost says what you're saying, the same thing that I think it was Harvard-educated biologist Randy Olson, turned filmmaker, who made films like Sizzle, a global warming comedy, and things like that. You know, and he's talking about climate change, and he's talking about evolution in another one of his films, Flock of Dodos, is... People get turned off by just the plain theory, but if you put it in context with a narrative, the ones that he tells, the ones that you're advocating telling, the ones that we do as well, right? So one of the chapters in a textbook of a course I teach starts with a calcium carbide reaction to produce acetylene. Who cares? Chemical engineers don't even care about that until you realize that was exactly the chemical reaction that the German chemical industry was trying to exploit toward the end of the war, World War II, to completely transform from petroleum to coal. And had they done that, they would have avoided literally running out of petrol in North Africa and parts of Europe after the Battle of the Bulge, and they might have turned the tide of the war. I mean, it's a great story. It's an interesting story. So it seems as though what you're saying is economics however dry people think it is, can also benefit from the narrative, maybe a little humor to help make that better.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right, so let's do this. Let's take a quick break, but when we come back, let's talk about two things. One, how your colleagues feel about your approach to humor, because some of mine don't always feel that way. And then let's get into some examples, specifically the cartoon guides to economics that you've actually written. We've got some issues with the phone, so I'm not sure if we'll be able to put you on the air. But if you are listening to us live Wednesdays noon to 1 and have a question or comment for the world's only stand-up economist, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. We'll at least try to get your question out on the air for Yoram to answer it. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, science only funnier. Okay, cool.
Every Monday night on Continental Drift, we pick a country and bring you music from that country. Your hosts, DJ Nuke and DJ Wiz, make your world a little smaller, one country at a time, every Monday from 10 p.m. to midnight. Once again, that's Continental Drift, Mondays, 10 p.m. to midnight, right here on WREK Atlanta.
The North Avenue Lounge is WREK's interview show. Every Monday at noon, you can hear a conversation with almost anyone. Artists, writers, professors, students, scientists, engineers, musicians, and other fascinating people from Georgia Tech and elsewhere. We've talked about everything from building an astrophysics lab to dancing ballet to being a blacksmith. Tune in each Monday at noon to hear an interesting conversation about almost anything on the North Avenue Lounge, right here on WREK Atlanta.
You believe in WREK?
I believe in WREK.
Hello? Hi, do you want to go to a party with me? No, the game's on. Oh, I almost forgot. I'll be right there.
We like sports and we don't care who knows. From shooting hoops to the Super Bowl. We like sports and we don't care who knows.
Football, tennis, hockey.
We like sports, and we care that you know. That's the Ramblin' Rec Report, 6 o'clock on Wednesdays. We'll talk football, basketball, softball, baseball, you name it. We have it. That's the Ramblin' Rec Report, 6 o'clock on Wednesdays, here on WREK Atlanta.
Whether it's rock, blues, electronic, hip-hop, R&B, or reggae, they all have one thing in common. You can hear them all during the Rock, Rhythm, and Wolves sound block Monday through Thursday from 1 to 6 p.m. and 1 to 5 p.m. on Fridays, only at WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box. Doing an admirable job, Austin Redd, who's our new engineer, and hopefully will be for a while. Okay, but the look on his face says he hasn't given up on us completely yet. And we're talking with Dr. Yoram Bauman, the world's only stand-up economist. That would be a stand-up comedian who does economics. And Yoram, can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay, good. Before the break, I had said I wanted to ask you, what do your colleagues think of that? Because, you know, those of us who do what you do, we do science and engineering, we do comedy. Some people really like that. They think it's a good thing, because certainly chemical engineering, biology, you know, economics could use a little humor to engage better people. Some people don't like it. Have there been any of your colleagues that are just, well, this doesn't belong in economic theory?
Yeah, I think it's the same. I mean, there are some folks who, have their underwear on a little too tight or whatever.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it.
And then they're just, I think the idea is that you can't be funny and serious at the same time, and that's actually not true.
Right.
Like some of the, their humor is a great way to convey information, and cartoons are also a great way to convey information. It's
right.
kind of the same thing where there's
right.
this sort of dismissal of, oh, if you're doing something with cartoons or if you're doing something with humor, then you're not real. You're not being serious.
Right.
And that's just wrong.
But they use it in marketing. They use it in sales. They use it to engage everyone else. Why not use it in education? In fact, ironically, the last time I was in Seattle, I was talking with the associate director of a research center out there, who was a former NSF program officer, who told me about a cartoon book, or do we say graphic novel now? Maybe that's what we do to make it sound better. On chemistry. And of course, anyone that's learned a second language, when I lived in Switzerland, I learned German through Asterisk and Obelix, which is a cartoon language book. Why not a cartoon book on economics? And you have two of them, right? One on microeconomics and one on macroeconomics, correct?
That's right. Co-authored okay. with and illustrated by my colleague Grady Klein.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got a micro book and a macro book, and we're actually working on a third book now about climate change.
Oh, okay, great. So tell us about the cartoon books on micro and macro economics and what makes them unique and why you think maybe the cartoon genre might actually help us out.
Well, I think, for one thing, economics and maybe some of the other subjects you mentioned, chemistry and physics and things like this is one of those disciplines where it takes more motivation to get students to open the book and
mm-hmm.
Sort of plunge into what can end up being really fascinating material. And I think we try hard in the cartoon books to tell a story,
mm-hmm.
and that's something that textbooks don't always do a great job of.
Right.
And we try to tell a story with humor and the visual display of information, visual presentation style mm-hmm. that you get from a graphic novel, if you want to be fancy about it, or from
right.
a cartoon, is actually quite appealing. I mean, when I was a kid, you mentioned the chemistry cartoon book, which I think is one of Larry Gonick's, and
yes.
he has a whole series
yes.
of cartoon books about history.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was a kid, I read the book that he had about genetics, the cartoon guide to genetics.
Right.
And they're just super accessible, and people tell me that they use my books in their classes or if they're studying economics, and some of them are older students, and they've got kids who are 10 or 12, and their kids pick up the cartoon books and maybe can't understand all of it, but
mm-hmm.
love the fact that that they can relate to something that their mom or their dad is studying, and they can pick up the humor and kind of get interested in the topic. And once you get the interest level up, then that's sort of half the battle.
Wow. So people actually use it in classes. Do they use it as the textbook, or do they use it as supplementary material?
I think a couple of places use it as a textbook, and I actually have a free online micro textbook that follows the same path as the micro cartoon book.
Right.
Much more often, it's used with, it's packaged with another textbook. So
right.
there's a...
Right.
My publishing company actually has a sister publishing company. It's both divisions of Macmillan.
Mm-hmm.
And so the cartoon books are offered for free with the textbooks that like Paul Krugman publishes or Cowan Tabarrak. And I sometimes joke that students will buy the textbook for $220 and then not read it, and then they'll buy the cartoon book for $12, and that's the one that they actually read.
So let me see if I get this straight. You are sometimes paired with Paul Krugman's text on economics.
That's right.
That just blows my mind. So, do you ever get to write op-eds in the New York Times with him? Or seems to me if they're going to put you up there as the supplementary text, that's extremely impressive that they would do something
Paul
like
that. Krugman, so I actually now run the humor session at the American Economic Association annual meeting.
Yes, I did read that on your website, yeah.
Which also comes to Atlanta occasionally.
Yeah.
And as part of that humor session, which we've been doing for 4 or 5 years now, I perform, and then we get a couple other folks who are interested in taking a stab at economics comedy. And a couple of years ago, Paul Krugman came and performed.
Wow. I'm just freaking out.
He wrote a paper, this was back in the 70s, that was never published, that we ended up finally publishing two or three years ago in a journal that I'm, an economics journal that I'm associated with, where I edit the humor section of the journal. So we publish a funny paper every quarter. And we ended up publishing his paper after this 30-year time delay, and it's a paper about, you'd love this paper, it's about, it's the theory of interstellar trade. And in addition to being a Nobel Prize winning economist, and Krugman won his Nobel Prize for working on trade theory, he's also a big science fiction fan.
Okay.
And so the premise of this paper is, you know, let's think about what trade would look like if we had trade between solar systems.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were going to do that, then presumably you need spaceships that are traveling close to the speed of light, and so you no longer have time simultaneity because of Einstein and special relativity and all that stuff. And so the question he looks at in the paper is, which clock should you use to calculate interest rates, the clocks on the planet or the clocks on the spaceship?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a whole bunch of really, and he's a, whatever you think about his politics, he's a great writer and a whole bunch
of really fun. And some
jokes.
Of his op-ed pieces do take a lighter look at things, but despite the fact it's sort of a funny jaunt into economics and the way society works, it's very thought-provoking. And if even if it's a silly paper, if it gets you to think about certain aspects educationally, it's already worth it. It's already a useful thing to stimulate people to think about these things. I have to tip my hat to you folks in economics then. You are light years, no pun intended, ahead of us here in science and engineering, because to actually have humor sessions and humor papers in some of these things, we're just not there. The Journal of the American Chemical Society is not there at all. But the potential is, right? So we've had Harry Croteau on the program, who shared the Nobel Prize on Buckminster Fullerene. And he's a very interesting artistic design person, very, very funny. He's the guy who said on the show that you not only have to discover something important that has significant impact to get the Nobel Prize, you got to give it a cool name. And supposedly he's the guy that came up with Buckminster Fullerene after the geodesic dome of Buckminster Fuller. And he would be, like Paul, a great guy to write such a paper, to deliver such a paper, to put a humorous spin on things, if for no other reason to keep people from falling asleep at this conference. And you've given me some brilliant ideas, but it's going to take a while to get the engineers and the physicists and the biologists and the chemists to do this sort of thing. I
definitely recommend the Annals of Improbable Research, which was one of the entrees to my career.
Which I have heard of, yes.
Uh-huh. And they present at their humor sessions at the AAAS meetings, they present a wide variety of papers. I do remember one. It was an engineering paper. It was about the strapless dress and sort of how come strapless dresses don't fall down.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a terrific and very funny paper. There was another one about sort of why woodpeckers don't get headaches, or how they're, you know, they have these kind of amazing brain mechanisms inside their head that prevent damage to their brain from all of that rapping. So there's always funny stuff to be found in the world, and it's just a matter of opening your eyes and then having a venue for presenting it.
Right. And like I said, the scientists and engineers were a little bit behind what you're doing. So I must say I'm extremely impressed that you would do that sort of thing. But so you obviously do a lot of corporate things at meetings, as do I, as do our other colleagues that do this. And the way I pitch it to these meetings is, you know, you're there for 2 days, 3 days, 5 days, and it's just paper after paper of highly technical stuff. And even people that write those papers and give those papers, you know, by the third day mixer or the introductory cocktail hour or the banquet on the end, even we're ready for something a little lighter. And I think that's the only reason you and I do this sort of stuff, is because those guys get tired too. Is that a fair statement, that these guys are ready for a joke once in a while too?
Yeah, I mean, all work and no play, you know, makes for dull conferences and dull meetings.
Right.
Everybody needs a break. And one of the things that I love about the career that I have now, you know, I spend time doing comedy and I work on these cartoon books and I work on carbon taxes, and I get to have a mix of different things going on, and you need to do that. You can't spend spend all day thinking necessarily about the exact same thing, or else, you know, your brain will atrophy.
Right. So then would you agree, and there's lots of cognitive theory on this, everything from Gladwell to very, you know, heavy detailed sorts of theories that say that, you know, those of us that do a little right brain crazy stuff, you know, on the humor side actually makes us more creative on the, you know, more left brain technical side. Do you think that helps you out in your search for new economic theories?
Well, I'd like to think so, but I don't know enough to say for sure.
Yeah. There are people who suggest it.
I do think that it kind of opens up your mind and allows you to consider all sorts of possibilities that people might otherwise close off.
Right, right. Yeah, the whole idea of actually writing a paper on a humorous topic just seems amazing to me. My colleague, the mathematician Lou Lufton, and I just published a paper for the American Society of Engineering Education that took a serious look at humorous improv for exploring idea space and described designing a lead oxide particle coating reactor from a flatulence joke. But there was no joke there. That was actually the serious transition that we used to actually get there. But the idea of actually humorous papers really intrigues me. So let's move on to a serious topic, right? So there's something that you're interested in and you work on, and that is something that is extremely controversial, and we never shy away from controversial topics here on Inside the Black Box. The whole idea of the economic impacts of global warming and carbon taxes. So what are your thoughts on that?
Although it's actually not, I think, it's controversial in the general public. It's not all that controversial in academia. And you think that economists tend to be a pretty argumentative bunch of folks.
Okay.
But economists pretty much say, look, you know, we're not climate scientists, so we're going to trust what the climate scientists say. And the climate scientists say that the planet is warming and that humans are largely responsible for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to the policy questions about, okay, like, should we do something about it? And if so, what should we do? And economists pretty much across the political spectrum, from pretty left-wing economists like Paul Krugman to pretty right-wing economists, including both of Mitt Romney's economic advisors, Art Laffer from the Laffer Curve fame, one of Reagan's economic advisors, think that what we should do about it is reform our tax system in a way that will help reduce carbon emissions and will help boost the economy. So we can have, for example, if we had a tax on carbon emissions, a carbon tax, a tax on the carbon content of fossil fuels, that would raise the price of fossil fuels, and economists would argue that you need to do that. You need to provide an incentive for people to reduce consumption, to switch to other sources of electricity, to think more carefully about what kind of car you're driving, how far do you live from work, that sort of stuff. And to counter the effects of those higher prices for fossil fuels, you can take the money from the carbon tax and use it to reduce income taxes, payroll taxes, sales taxes, taxes on things that we want more of, like jobs and investment, and that are currently being stifled by these higher taxes that exist right now. And so the idea of what's called a revenue-neutral tax swap or environmental tax reform is really one that's endorsed by economists kind of across the political spectrum just because it makes so much sense. You know, we have these taxes right now on things we want more of, like jobs and investment, and we can lower taxes on those things and make up the revenue by having taxes on things we want less of, like carbon emissions. So that's what I work on.
But this is basically sort of the basic view of economists in general, right? That by making these manipulations in a logical way, assuming people are logical, you can change choices by changing motivation, right? So why
you can change
is this?
Choices, you can change the choices that people face. So,
right,
for instance,
right,
and this is not just theory, right? In British Columbia, to the north of where I live in Seattle, they have had a carbon tax, a revenue-neutral mm-hmm. carbon tax, in place for the last 4 or 5 years, and it's reduced carbon emissions there. You can actually see the impact that it's had on the choices that people make about, well, you know, what kind of car are you driving, and is your home insulated, and all that sort of stuff, and is your factory using the most energy efficient processes possible. And their economy is doing fine. So it's actually a terrific success story, the carbon tax up in British Columbia, and I'm working on bringing it here to Washington State, and then I talk to folks in other places about bringing it to their location, and hopefully at some point nationally.
Okay, and it seems perfectly logical. But let's do this. Let's take another quick break, and we come back. Let's maybe talk about the challenge you face outside of British Columbia or outside relatively liberal Seattle, Washington, in getting people to understand the logic of this thing, and whether or not your comedy, your comedy presentation, which I saw on your website, is true that choices are bad. So once again, if we've got anyone listening live Wednesdays noon to 1 and you can get through to us, at least to leave us a question, even if we can't get you on the air, for Yoram about carbon taxes, economics, and the use of humor therein, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
The Subgenius Hour of Swag.
Yeah, that's Subgenius.
These are people who are seriously suffering from a major problem.
Yeah, ain't it groovy?
The media is the key to power.
My goodness, I'm stunned.
You think I'm crazy, right?
And there's no stopping the bomb as it spreads from town to town.
Making sense so far? Well, don't worry about it, kids. I don't understand a word of it either.
The Subgenius Hour of Slack. Saturdays at midnight. WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Repent! Quit your job! Slack off! And pray for!
Don't adjust your radio, folks. This is Simply Kosher Noise. Oy vey, these promos never get good signal this far from the Holy Land, so tune into Kosher Noise with your host, DJ Meltz. Feel that Hebrew groove all the way from the tips of your payos down to the soles of your tevas. Tune in to Kosher Noise Monday nights from 7 to 8 p.m. with your host, DJ Meltz.
Hi, I'm Mitch Limmer, the host of Let's Talk Business, which airs here on WREK every Tuesday from 12 to 1. Join me each week on this award-winning show that is celebrating its 20th year on the radio as I interview leading entrepreneurs, authors, CEOs, young entrepreneurs, and more from all over the world. Again, tune in every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. for Let's Talk Business, where your success is our business.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where the title of today's show, Stand Up Economics, is featuring Yoram Bauman, who is the world's only stand-up comedian economist. And before the break, we were starting to talk about, revenue-neutral taxes that will, tax things that are bad, carbon, these kinds of emissions. And then you're mentioning, because it's revenue-neutral, we'll go back and then reduce taxes elsewhere. So seems logical. Seems reasonable, but one of the funny sets that you do takes these 10 basic rules about economics and translates them, and one of them is that choices are bad and people are illogical. Is that what keeping folks like you from getting these things, these ideas spreading further, or is it something more complicated?
It's a whole mess of things, and I think the fundamental issue is actually lack of trust in government, and to some extent, lack of trust in our fellow citizens, right? Because government ultimately is in a democracy, is the government of your fellow citizens. So, for instance, when I talk about this idea, and you're right, I live in liberal Seattle, and the West Coast is pretty liberal, but I give talks to the Florida Bankers Association and the Barry Goldwater Institute in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm actually coming to outside of Atlanta later this summer. I give talks all over the place and to all sorts of different audiences. And the number one sort of response that I get from folks who are sort of on the concerned side of things, or they say, well, it's a nice idea in theory, but in practice, what's going to happen is you're going to, you know, raise this carbon tax, and you're not going to reduce the income taxes or payroll taxes. You're not going to do the other half of what you say you're going to do. So, and that really gets down to a trust in government issue. And I can point to British Columbia where they've done this, and they've followed through on their promise. Mm-hmm. It was actually passed by a right of center government in British Columbia,
right.
And they have reduced taxes by as much or more than the taxes that they've raised from the carbon tax, but still people, even in British Columbia, people don't necessarily believe that that's true, because it's very easy to just say, oh, you know, to get cynical and say, I don't believe that they're doing it. You know, somehow, you know, I'm getting screwed. And it's very difficult to fight that sort of cynicism and to challenge that level of mistrust that people have in government.
Right. But it seems that what you ought to be doing is taking the humor approach and making fun of the fact that nobody trusts anyone in government, and at least trying to, for lack of a better phrase, work the room.
And I actually do that. I have a routine where I divide people up across the political spectrum and sort of make fun of everybody in equal measure. It's a great routine, my left-right-center routine.
Right.
So I do that, and, you know, the ultimate goal of the content in the material that I present, when I talk to these groups about carbon taxes, it's just to plant a seed. And somewhere down the road, my belief is that climate change is real, and that it's serious, and that at some point we're going to decide that we want to do something about it. And I'm just planting a seed in people's minds that if and when they get to a point where they agree that this is real and that we should do something about it, that they'll think about this idea that has appeal kind of across the political spectrum from economists. It's something that Bob Inglis, who's actually a former congressman, very conservative congressman, Republican congressman from South Carolina, now runs an organization called the Energy and Enterprise Initiative that promotes this idea nationally. So it's got sort of bipartisan appeal, and I think that for a lot of folks like who are not on board with what I would say is the consensus, the scientific consensus on climate change, I think it's partly because they think that if they agree that climate change is a problem, then that means that they're going to have to agree to this sort of path to socialism, and that, you know, we'll all have to live on communes and wear compostable underwear and things like that. And
I've tried compostable underwear. I don't recommend it.
It's not great. And the good news is that you don't have to do that, right?
Right.
You can actually deal with climate change in a very market-friendly, pro-capitalist, pro-jobs kind of way, and that's part of the message that I'm trying to share with folks.
Wow, so planting a seed, that's an interesting way to put it. I never really thought about that. I mean, I'm the guy that goes out and talks about climate change, makes the jokes on climate change and on, you know, evolution having its own set of warning stickers here in Cobb County, Georgia, where my kids go to school. In fact, I was at the Fringe Festival this weekend and making that joke about all these sorts of things. And I often wonder, does it make an impact? But you're right, you're not going to change things overnight, but it probably does plant a seed for these sorts of folks. So, wow, that's a good way to think about it. So that's why you're so happy, right? I mean, most comedians I know, they're out there on the road, they're like, nobody listens to me. And you're like, at least there's a seed being planted, and you're hoping that one day you're going to see the benefits of this?
Yeah, I think that's my hope. That's it.
Okay, no, and that's certainly a good hope to have. So, so let me ask you a question then. So you're out, you know, doing a lot of gigs, things like that. Any interesting things that you've learned on the road when you're mixing comedy with economics? I mean, I learned interesting things both about, you know, science and engineering and about comedy. One thing I learned is that no one ever bought me a drink for being a chemical engineer, but they did for being a comedian. That's probably the things I like the most about being a comedian. Any interesting anecdotes about learning in those two areas that you found on the road?
Well, when I tell people that I'm an economist and I do stand-up comedy, they don't really ask me about the economics so much. They, like you said, they ask about the stand-up comedy. Mostly, I just have good stories. Like, I did a show for a very conservative crowd in Minnesota, and I did economics comedy, and they appreciated that. And then I did this little pitch about climate change, which they were a little less enthusiastic about. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the talk, this fella came up to me and said that the funniest part of my whole routine was the part about climate change. You know, so it's fun to meet people from different walks of life. So mm-hmm. I did a show that terrified me at the time. I'm happy to talk about it now. On the banks of the Arkansas River for a group of trucking executives outside of Pine Bluff, Arkansas. And they were like, it was almost like we were two different alien species, you know, like here is this kind of this liberal guy from Seattle with a PhD and then these trucking executives from Arkansas. And we ended up having a great time. Like, we were super friendly. We didn't see eye to eye about politics or guns mm-hmm. or climate change necessarily, but we had a great time together. They were a fun crowd, and they enjoyed, you know, most of the stuff that I had to say. And so I think that's really the fun part is getting to meet people from different places and see what they're like and trying to figure out. It's almost a little bit of a game, like trying to figure out how to connect to people from different backgrounds.
So actually, what you're describing is a standard comedy thing, right? It's winning the crowd over, and sometimes you'll lose them. I've worked with a guy, Jerry Farber, in the past here, who's an older comedian, but he's kind of a liberal guy, and the key is you'll tell a couple liberal jokes, especially in a place like Georgia. This happened to me at a comedy club in Florida once, where I think it was during the Daytona 500, where you had a lot of NASCAR fans did not like my NASCAR jokes. And you kind of got to work to find the spot and bring them back and things like that. I think that's true of comedians everywhere. So in Arkansas, did you fear for your safety for a while there? Were you worried they were going to come at you in the parking lot like a pack of dingoes?
Only when I didn't even really tell a joke about guns, but I mentioned guns, and this guy in the back, sort of a good old boy, he was like, "Don't talk about my guns, boy." And at that point, I started looking for the emergency exits. And I said that I was looking for the emergency exits, and they laughed. And,
okay.
We had a
so this time. Sounds like me. I was out at a university. I think it was part of the Texas University system in Permian Basin, which is near Odessa, Texas, which I think is 29 miles from Midland, Texas, George and Laura Bush's hometown. There's a big billboard that says that. And I may have told some jokes, and not nasty jokes or anything like that. I mean, because I'm assuming my act is kind of like yours. It's pretty PGG most of the time when you do these things. It gets a little spicier if people are drinking at the thing. So it wasn't anything particularly nasty, but these, I don't think they appreciated any George Bush jokes that close to Midland, Texas. But let me ask you another question, and that is, so you do stuff at colleges, right?
I do, yeah.
So, and this is an interesting point that I learned when we were trying to teach statistics using humor as part of a National Institutes of Health funded initiative for a summer biostatistics institute at Emory University. And the guys at Emory University were really great. They invited me to take part of their thing, and it was on analysis of variance, and make it funny. And the chairman of the department attended my presentation, and he walked up to me afterwards and he shook my hand and he said, "Yo, that was really funny. Let's see what the students think about it." Students hated it. And I think it's this millennial generation who, you know, they love their edgy little jokes in South Park and Family Guy and things like that. But that's their dirty little secret back in their apartment or dorm room. They don't expect figures of authority. And I hate to break it to you. With a PhD in economics, you are a figure of authority to you know, take the 10 principles of economics and just turn them into, well, decisions are bad and choices are bad and people are not logical and just make wacky fun of that. Have you ever had a reaction from college students like that?
They're usually pretty receptive. They're usually at a point where they're dying for some humor.
Okay, okay. All right, that's good.
I do get folks who are sort of confused and are sometimes they're a little troubled about, like, do you really think choices are bad? And sort of the what, you know, what part of your act is funny and is just for humor value, and what part is funny but has a serious subtext to it.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I like to think of it as, well, that's something that's fun to think about, and that's kind of a part of the educational process is thinking for yourself and trying to figure out what's the serious part and what's the not serious part, what's just the jokes. But some people, I think some students maybe get a little confused if they just expect to come to class and be told the truth, you know?
Yes, that's actually a very good point, and I couldn't agree with you more. So if I think about watching your act and you sort of break some of these things down, and your conclusion of some of these is that choices are bad or choices are really bad or choices are not so bad, and it's not that you're literally saying choices are bad. I think what you're saying is choices are what makes the whole thing both interesting and complex. And you're right, we do have a lot of students here at Georgia Tech and elsewhere that are just like, they make that transition as a freshman from high school, and they're like, well, you're going to tell me what's right, what's wrong, what I should think. And the point is, with economics and with science, with engineering, you know, let's take climate change, for example. As a chemical engineer who has a joint appointment in the bioengineering program, I think we'll all agree that rapid exponential hockey stick graph of CO2 going up has ramifications. What it is, I don't think we even know, because we'll say, well, global warming may be part of it if you look at greenhouse gas theory. But then if you realize we're also releasing particulates in the air, particulates will form artificial clouds and actually can absorb stuff. They will actually cool the earth. And about the only thing we agree on is carbon is changing something. And you're right. I think a lot of people want, well, it's warming, it's cooling, it's a weird combination of the two. And it's actually extremely complicated. And if you look at, you know, changes in fish populations and currents, and you throw all that sort of stuff in there, it's just an extremely complicated thing. And people kind of want the answer. That's really interesting. Do you, when you do your act and you're doing sort of this funny thing, have you thought about transitioning to doing something that is more educational? Because I know you do some teaching, right?
I have done some teaching, yeah, and I'd like to think that a bunch of the stuff that I talk about, even in joke form, is educational.
Right.
In terms of providing insights, if nothing else, insights into the way that economists think about the world.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's a good idea. For the preview for the Fringe Festival this past weekend, I basically said, look, I'm going to make a lot of jokes. Some of them are just going to be from my comedy act. Some of them are going to be from my lecture. Some of them are going to be from my research. Your job as an audience member, figure out which is which. And if for no other reason, maybe that just gets them to think about the field a little bit better. So,
we do it in the cartoon books. Mm-hmm. You know, we combine the humor but the main point of the cartoon books is educational, right? But humor and cartoons are the vehicle for doing that. The econ cartoon books and the one we're working on now on climate change.
Is it ever going to be on Cartoon Network following SpongeBob SquarePants? Oh, is that Sorry.
Maybe on Adult Swim.
Oh, Adult Swim. Okay, no, that's good. That's good. And let me ask you one final thing, nerd comedian to nerd comedian. Do you do a slightly different act when you're at the banquet and people are drinking wine versus you're at 9 o'clock in the morning and you're the kickoff guy? You know, meaning is it a little edgier when it's late at night and people are drinking alcohol?
It depends on the audience and whether they're comfortable with whether they're comfortable with material that's a little edgy, and it also depends on how much economics they know. So I sort of, I'll arrange the routine depending on their comfort level and maybe how much alcohol they've had.
Okay. All right. So once again, it comes down to the old comic adage: know your audience. And you're right. I did a general audience this week, but next week I'm in front of the Chemical Engineering Division of the American Society of Engineering Education, and I will be making thermodynamics jokes. So you're right. It makes perfect sense. So we've come to the end of the program, the portion that we like to call "What Have We Learned?" And I guess we've learned that humor is alive and well in the annals of improbable research in the AAAS. And I'm certainly going to look into that and talk to my fellow science and engineering comedians about it. And I think your message is that, yes, humor helps. It sort of helps with what you call the motivational factor in getting these sorts of things going. And then you, having found a niche in economics, hopefully are explaining that extremely well now, given your knowledge of monopoly pricing. And then, you know, the sort of self-deprecating humor that you make about economics is appreciated by most people, except for, and I quote, those who have their underwear on too tight. And I am certainly looking forward to your third book to accompany the first two cartoon books on micro and macroeconomics on climate change, right? That's what the next one's gonna.
That's right. Next April.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then what I'm hoping is, and I'm going to sort of take this philosophy about the importance of science and even this, the global climate change issue, that, you know, comedians that work on science and economics and engineering and these sorts of things may not be changing the world, but at least they're planting the seed so that with Tim Lee and myself can hopefully get people to accept climate change, they'll at least understand the logic of your revenue neutral carbon taxes, and hopefully that will work out really well. And then finally, we have a link to our on our website, insidetheblackbox.org, which links to your website where they can find out about where you're going to be appearing and if they were interested in having you come bring the humor side of economics to their organization or symposium, they could get in contact with you about having you come down and talk to them, correct?
That's right.
All right. Anything else I left off? Any final messages we want for our audience?
You know, another thing they can find on my website is if they're interested in reviewing drafts of the cartoon climate change book, we sort of do a semi-crowdsourcing wiki kind of thing.
Oh, sweet.
Folks who are interested in looking at drafts can check it out there, too.
All right. I will certainly be doing that. But other than that, Yoram, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, and if any of our listeners have a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. We are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Thank you very much for our new engineer, Austin Redd, sitting in today. Our theme music, which you didn't hear today, but we're going to figure that out by next week, is performed and written by Bill and Mary Hunt. And please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.